Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
Well, you've just been listening to What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong. And depending on how you look at it, it can be a wonderful world. Today's pretty wonderful for me because, Rachel Stewart, you're here in the psychotherapist chair. A big welcome to you.
Thank you. And that's so spooky that you just said that you played What a Wonderful World. I can't quite believe it, because I nearly put that in my first pick of songs and I chose not to in the end, and you played it anyway.
Well, you wouldn't be the first person to say that, Rachel. It's okay. Such an all-time favorite, isn't it? And yes, it's so uplifting. And I put it on at the beginning of every one of these shows because I want to start with a positive vibe. You know, I want us all to feel that no matter what's going on, we can still find things in this world that are truly unbelievably wonderful. This morning, before we recorded, I just had 5 minutes outside. And I was looking across to the mountains here in Wanaka, and I thought to myself, really? How can you ever let yourself get down when all you've got to do is walk out your door, Jerry, and look at those beautiful snow-covered mountains?
If only it were that simple, Jerry, we'd all be mentally so healthy, but unfortunately it doesn't seem to be as easy as that sometimes.
Well, and that's why this show is here, really, because I'm talking to Kiwis all about how they lift themselves, how do they cope with trauma, and what gets them out of bed in the morning. And I wonder, we could start off, Rachel. Many of the listeners will be very familiar with your voice and you. And you've been on RCR lots of times, and you've contributed massively to the free speech and reality debates that are going on this station. So big thank you for that. And to the listeners, you can check out, if you just go to replays and you type in Rachel Stewart, you'll find all sorts of wonderful recordings of Rachel. But I wonder if we started with what works for you, what lifts you when you're feeling a bit low and you're feeling a bit flat. What do you do to give yourself a lift?
Well, you know, when you get too flat, it becomes very hard to even know what to do, but I haven't been that flat too many times, but I have been very flat for periods of time. But generally I get outside, I take the dog, we go and shoot a possum, I might go hunting. It's generally outside activities. I never make any big decisions inside. I always make any big decisions when I'm outside about life. So I guess it's definitely being out there with my dog and feeling the wind in my face and feeling the rain and the sun. And so, yes. And, you know, little things like doing Wordle, that helps. Puzzles. Yeah. You talked about, I listened to your one recording about depression, which I really enjoyed. And you talked about yourself there when you were younger and you started doing jigsaws, you became obsessed with jigsaws. I don't do those, but I definitely do the New York Times crossword, and I totally relate to that because it gets me out of my head and I'm a word person and it really helps me a lot. So getting out of bed in the morning, I've got to get out of bed because I have animals to tend to, and when you have an animal to tend to or animals to tend to, you get out of bed. So that's been a very constant and very big constant in my life, and I'm very grateful for it.
What animals have you got, Rachel?
Well, at times I've had, stock to tend to, sheep, cattle, dogs, heaps of dogs, farm dogs. And obviously, of course, when I was terribly involved in falconry, you might have a hawk you had to feed and take out and do things to. So, you know, who knows? And there's always animals to go and keep away from the house, like wild pigs or goats. And while I may kill them, I still love them.
Yeah. Animals are amazing, aren't they? There is something profoundly soothing about animals. And I don't know whether you knew this, Rachel, but during COVID, the number of pets that people that were sought after by people exploded. People were looking for pets all the way during lockdowns, and the various agencies that have rescue pets or whatever, they couldn't get enough pets in, from what I've heard, that so many people were suddenly recognizing their need for animals when they couldn't have human contact.
Well, sadly, of course, there's the other side, the dark side to that, is that then they abandoned them as soon as COVID was over, and they went, a lot of people did, and went back to work. They were handing them into the SPCA like nobody's business. So there is that side of humanity that I can't really relate to. Yes, and a lot of people fell in love with animals at that time and were great and have been great owners because of it. But I think the animals suffered a bit because suddenly people weren't home, you know. But I find animals are a constant theme in my life. When I was very young, I used to go and sleep. We had a dairy herd, of course, and I'd sneak out at sort of, 11 o'clock at night and go and sleep with my favourite cow and sleep on her udder. And then just before milking, when I could hear the dog starting up, I'd sneak back in so Dad didn't know I was out there with the cows. You know, I found them very comforting.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, really. Not so much in the middle of winter. But, yeah, in summer I definitely went and slept out there with them and slept on their udder, and I cuddled up to them and they were just absolutely fine about it. I had a particular favourites and they were like, the cows' udders are so comforting, warm and milky, and, I didn't do anything kinky out there, but I certainly enjoyed their company. I love cows, yeah.
And that would be outside or in a barn?
Outside, yeah.
Wow. Wow, I've never heard that. I've never heard of anyone doing that, Rachel. That's just blown me away.
Oh, really?
So how old were you when you were doing that? How old were you when you were going out and sleeping with the cows?
Oh, probably. It's a bit strange now. But, probably from on the farm, probably from 5 to about 10.
Wow.
Yeah. I knew my parents wouldn't want me out of bed doing that. So I don't think they ever knew.
Amazing.
It was great.
Amazing. Yeah. It's funny when you're little and you do things and it just seems perfectly normal when you do it. And then later on when you grow up, you think, oh, that was a bit odd. I used to, when I was about 6 or 7 years old and started at school, I was really struggling. I had some form of dyslexia and I couldn't get on with the school and I didn't think much of the school. And I used to just, at the break time, in the morning break, I used to just, when everyone went back at the end of the morning break, I just used to hang out around one of the corners and then I'd just go outside the school gates and wander into town. And I used to sit down and have coffee like a grown up at the age of 7. I can't believe the coffee sellers would have even wondered, why is this 7-year-old boy walking into a coffee house? And I crossed like the main arterial road between the school and all the shops. It was in a tiny little town called Leigh-on-Sea in Essex in England. And the main arterial road from Southend to London, it was like 4 lanes I had to cross as a 7-year-old to get to the shops. I used to wander around, I'd smell the coffee and I'd go in. And I did this, I think, kind of almost every day for about 3 months before someone noticed.
that to me is something I've never heard of before. So there you go. I mean, we just called that wagging school. But the coffee part, going and sitting and having a coffee, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it was something. So it just strikes me that it was only many, many years later that I thought, well, in fact, when I became a school teacher, I thought, that was a bit weird. Nobody noticed.
Now you've pointed out about the cows, I hadn't thought of that for a long time. It is probably a bit weird too, but
I really
enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful, beautiful. And tell us a bit about your childhood, Rachel. Tell me where you grew up and tell us a little bit about what your sort of childhood was like. I'd love to hear that.
Well, I grew up in Whanganui, of all places, in the North Island on the West Coast, born into a farming family. Father was Whanganui-based and had taken over the farm from his father. My mother was from a farming family in Taranaki. Taranaki, I should say correctly. And we had a dairy farm and a sheep farm. Dairy farm was pretty, maybe a few miles out of town, and it was one of the first in the region. We had, I think, the oldest cow shed in the Whanganui area at the time. And then the sheep farm was another 4 miles up a side valley road. And so we're living the dream. I mean, I was the youngest of four, and you could go anywhere you wanted pretty much, although going out to sleep with the cows probably wasn't on the list. But you could go anywhere you wanted during the day. You could sled down hills. I used to make sleds go down hills, chase my older brothers and sister around. We had dogs, we had animals, we had everything. It was, I felt like I was sort of king of the castle in some ways. To have land that you can always access and do things, go and ride a horse, or that's very special. My parents split up when I was 11, unfortunately, or fortunately, and I then was whisked away with my mother because I was the youngest by quite a bit. And we moved to the States, so that became a whole new chapter, and that was a bit of a shock, really. But it's something I'd never change. Of course, you can't. But it was great experience being in California in the 70s. It was fantastic being in San Francisco and going to Haight-Ashbury and seeing, you know, the Castro. And I'm like, you know, I'm from Whanganui. I mean, the highlight of a Saturday night in Whanganui in the 60s and 70s was going to the pie cart in the main street. So suddenly I'm coming, going to Berkeley, you know, and seeing the university and seeing gay cops, you know, and the world was, I mean, we'd just come out of the 60s. So it was the place to be. And that was a major change for me and changed my life enormously forever. And my relationships with my siblings, probably not for the better. And relationship with my father changed, and it was okay. Relationship with my mother really changed. So I went there in 1970, end of 73, and came back in 76. So I went from 11 till 15, roughly.
Pretty important years for a young girl, right?
Very, I think. The music, the times, the politics. I've got a very deep understanding of American history, which I enjoy, and politics, not so much these days, but it's still interesting. And coming back to Whanganui in the middle of somewhere at the end of the fourth form, I think it was, being plunged back into Whanganui Girls College, picking up with all my primary school friends, because I'd sort of missed out intermediate by going to the States, and coming back to live with Dad. And coming straight back, it was like that never happened in a way. It was very odd, and I was never the same person. And I struggled a bit academically originally because I had come from a very loose arrangement in California. I found their education system incredibly easy. And if you're good at sport, you sort of got through. But I got back into it and did Latin and French and did okay. So it was just, yeah, it was a very interesting time, and it's had a huge impact on me.
I can imagine. And, you know, looking at it from the outside, I'm so jealous of anyone who spent the early 70s in San Francisco.
Yeah, shame I wasn't like 23 instead of 13, but there you are.
Yes.
But it got into me by osmosis, and I think I picked up on a lot of the California vibe of the 70s, where the world felt like it was just like you felt you're on the cusp of something completely fantastic. And I think they were interesting times too. It's all been downhill from there. California, anyway.
I tend to agree with you, Rachel. I mean, interestingly, in my field, psychotherapy, within I think about an hour's drive of each other, three of the greatest creators of revolutionary approaches to dealing with pain and the psychology of pain, they all lived within an hour of each other, and at least two of them met up. And that was Eric Byrne, who founded the approach I use, which is transactional analysis. Fritz Perls lived, you know, just a short way away, and he founded Gestalt therapy. And Carl Rogers lived not very far away, and he founded person-centered counseling and therapy. So, and those three approaches have spread across the whole world, and they all originated right over there in San Francisco. There must have been something in the water, I reckon.
Yeah, it was a fabulous place. And I still cry when I leave San Francisco. I don't cry very often in my life, but when I fly out of there, because I've traveled back regularly for years, and when I fly, particularly when I fly in, actually, I get very emotional. it is not the same place now. It is. And that so now I'm crying for different reasons, but it's still somewhere I left my heart, definitely. And it was my favorite city in the world, and probably still is in a fictitious place in my head, because it's not the reality now. It's changed. But it's a beautiful city. It has spawned great thinkers, great progress, and great liberality, if you're into that. Unfortunately, we're in a whole different paradigm now. But, yeah, wonderful, wonderful place. And I loved going to school there. I loved growing up there in the early teens. Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, would you be willing to share what it was that led your mum to leave and to go across there? And it sounds like she didn't come back with you. She stayed out there?
She stayed out there for a while, but they did come back. She left my father after 19 years of marriage. It wasn't a happy union, certainly in the last few years. I mean, they had separate beds at a time when I don't think that was a thing, really. Now it's quite a thing, even if you're happy. But they just weren't, they didn't, you know, we'd sit there and mum would say, tell your father to pass the salt, you know, this sort of thing, you know, Sunday. So it was crazy stuff. I only got the tail end of it. The older siblings probably saw a lot more than I did. But anyway, she left very soon after she met a man, or maybe she met him before, I don't know, who was an American who was back in New Zealand for a school reunion, because he'd gone to school in Whanganui when he was very young. He was a Scotsman, actually, but he lived in America for years. He was an American sailor. He'd been in the war, Marines, I think. And she fell in love and said, we're going to San Francisco. How do you feel about that? And there was a bit of lead-in time, and I felt nervous and excited in turns. And the day I left to go there for her new man and his life in San Francisco, I was, scared to say goodbye to my family and totally excited about getting on a DC-10 and flying to LA, because you couldn't go direct to San Francisco at that point. You couldn't even go direct. You had to stop in Hawaii. I remember that. It was scary time, but it was also very, made me grow up heaps, I'm sure.
And you had three elder brothers and sisters then?
Yeah, two older brothers and a sister, yeah, who were old enough not to come. All of them had left school. The older one was a policeman by that point, very early, young. He was 12 years older than me. The next one, my sister, is 10 years older than me. And she was at university, teachers college, so she wasn't going to go. And my older brother, who's 5 years older than me, was working with Dad on the farm, and he'd left school, so he wasn't coming either. So it was goodbye to all of that. And when I came back to Whanganui after, 4 years away or 3.5 years away, it was picking up where I'd left off. It was, it was really like, it was surreal. It was like I'd been doing the psychedelics that I wasn't doing, but everybody in San Francisco was.
So did you decide to come back? Was it your decision? Was it your mum's decision? Was it your dad's? Who, at the age of, 15 when you returned? I'm fascinated at this moment in your life.
Yes, well, I'll tell you what it was. It was that my stepfather and I weren't getting on, and I didn't like him particularly at times, although at times I thought he was great. He was a drinker, and he would beat my mother with monotonous regularity. Around about once every few months, and that morphed into him trying to beat me one day and my mother intervening, and I was on a plane within a week, and that's why I came back. But there was a lot of trepidation about that too, because I thought, if I come back and leave her, he's going to kill her. Mm. And he didn't, but I worried the whole time I was home, and it took her another year and a half to come back, and they moved back to Wellington. He worked on the tugboats in Wellington before he died, quite young at 52, I think it was. So, she did survive it, but I always worried about her. Mm.
And that's really interesting, because one of the themes that recurs in this program, Rachel, is the effect of trauma and how it passes through sometimes many generations. And I think you described your stepfather as having been in the war. Is that correct?
Yes.
And do you know what theatre of war he was in, or where he was, or anything about that?
Yes, he was. I know he was in the front line in Dunkirk. He was on boats. He was, he had a lot of stuff. So, I look at it now and realise it's going on for him, probably. But it didn't change the fact that as a child I was very scared of him, really.
Well, yes. And was it your mum who sent you away who decided, okay, that's it, she's got to go back? Yeah.
Yes.
So her protective instinct kicked in and it was okay for her to be beaten up by the sound of it, but not for you. And that crossed a line for her. And I can just imagine how tough that would have been for you to have left your mum knowing that on a regular basis, this highly traumatized guy, and how often do we get trauma followed by booze, followed by violence? It's almost, you could almost say it's the Kiwi pattern as well. I've come across this a great deal here, probably more than I did in the UK. I don't know why I say that. It's just very heavily populated in the UK. But here in New Zealand, people I've worked with, people I've met, so very often this is not the same story exactly, but of the pattern of, you know, trauma like a world war. And of course, we then lay on, I wonder if your stepfather, I wonder if his father was also in the First World War. That often happened, for example. I don't know if you know that happened.
I don't. I don't know much about his background at all. But I can tell you that, and this may shock some viewers, but some listeners, but I'm going to talk about this because I found it pretty cathartic. They came back and they moved to Wellington and my mother said, come down for a weekend. And I thought, okay. So I caught a bus and I was still school. I was probably sixth form or something. And I took the bus down for the weekend and they'd moved, bought a house somewhere in Wellington and in Parramatta, I think. And I went there for the weekend and he decided to get drunk one night. And I thought, oh, here we go. I wonder if he's going to do it now. And I was a bit older. I'd been home for a while. I was in my own country. I had my siblings, you know, in the back of my mind that were my backup, I thought. And he started hassling her and I thought, here we go, he's going to start doing it. And he started chasing around the room and then I said, you are not going to do this here. And I just went to grab the phone to call the cops actually. And he goes, I won't do anything. I won't do anything. And I put the phone down and then he pulls the phone out of the wall. And I remember thinking, okay. So then he chases her, slips over. Falls over because he's drunk. He's on the ground and I take my opportunity and I kicked him like you wouldn't believe. I broke two of his ribs. He couldn't go to work for a few months, told everyone who fell off a ladder. I said, if you touch my mother ever again, I will kill you. And I meant every word of it. And he, you know what? According to my mother, he never did. He was a 16-year-old girl, 17 maybe. Beating up a 50-something-year-old, 40-something, maybe late 40-year-old man, and he was terribly embarrassed, lied about it, but he never hit her again. So in some ways, and I've never done anything like that ever since. I've never had to be in a position like that, really. But I think in some ways it kind of worked. I think it woke him up a bit, and he never drank again like he drank before. So that was that.
Wow. It sounds like you shocked him into some realization that he had to change something.
Yeah. Well, I was back in my country. You know, you're in my country now, man, and you're not going to do that to my mother. So that was it. And I have a belief that if more people took responsibility for this kind of behavior before it gets to this point and possibly do what I did, maybe not the violence part, but it's what happened. I think it was all pent up in me and it just came out. And, you know, it changed his behaviour. If more men stepped up, for instance, when men hit their sisters, their mothers, I think we'd have less of a problem. But they don't tend to do it. They certainly don't tend to do it in this country. So they stay away. It's not my problem, you know. Well, I think it's all of our problems. I hate domestic violence.
And how big a theme in your life has standing up for justice, standing up for against damage and harm to people or animals, or I suspect the land as well. How much has that been a theme of your life, Rachel?
Well, I haven't thought about it too much, but if I was to think about it, and I am now, it's been the biggest theme of my life.
Yeah,
probably. I mean, it's something that I've always done. If I don't like injustice, I believe in justice and fairness and truth, actually. And I'm not a person who you can just tell me, you know, tell me it's something black when I know it's white. It's just not something that I can do. I think that's the rural aesthetic. We don't really work like that. So, yeah, my whole life I've been in a lot of trouble for standing up for some things. It's a theme. It's cost me a lot, actually. It's cost me a lot financially, but it's also cost me a lot emotionally. But you know what? It's one of those things you just can't change about yourself. I mean, I don't go out of my way. You know, people say, oh, you're brave and you're courageous. Or I don't go out of my way to be any of those things. I just don't think I got the gene where you have fear of speaking the truth. And going into the world that we're in now, where free speech is definitely on the wane, people don't want it, and I say what I think about certain things, it's a dangerous time for people like me. Of course, in Britain, you know, with all this stuff happening at the moment, with the immigration riots and Keir Starmer calling people right-wing thugs as a moniker, which it's too easy. People are getting locked up for just liking a tweet. So we've got massive problems that we're going to be facing, and a person like me could be in jail very soon.
Well, I'll be right there next to you, sister.
Good, good.
There'll be quite a good crowd in there. It'll be quite a party, I suspect.
Yes, I think so. I don't know where this is all leading, but a person like me is well-equipped emotionally to withstand these times quite well, and I've had years of this, so I'm watching with great interest but great trepidation too, because these times are nothing like you or I've ever seen. Jerry, I'm sure you agree.
Well, I do, and you know what, Rachel, even if I didn't agree, I'd be happy to hear your opinion, right?
Yes, and that's old-fashioned, and it's decent, and that's what I like. And, you know, we were brought up to be stoic. I mean, stoicism is kind of the rural psychology, to be honest. And part of me to this day still feels like I'm a very honest person, so I tell the truth, but I struggle telling people those stories I just told you, really. But I've started to do it more and more as I've got older because, you know, it feels like it's something people could use and possibly learn from, I don't know, or, you know, at least they learned something about me. But I still struggle these days to kind of really, I struggle with what I call the victimhood of sort of wokeness. I struggle with laying everything on the table and saying, oh, I'm triggered and I'm offended and all, you know, I just don't really do that. So it's, yeah, I can get offended, but I'm not going to make a big federal case out of it. Yeah, and that's just part of the rural DNA, and it's still hanging around. It's still there. It is tough work. It is hard. It's hard to be farming, and it's isolating, and you need a different kind of spirit. And from the average person, if you don't have a certain degree of stoicism, it's not an industry to get into. And so I guess it's a hangover. You know what, though? I kind of prefer that to hanging it all out. I mean, there's a place to hang it all out, probably talking to someone like you, you know, right now on radio, or in the therapy chair. And I do have a therapist I go to from time to time, and that's where I go and do it. But in my personal life, I tend to just laugh stuff off as much as possible, and I don't really show people that underbelly. I don't expose myself terribly strongly, but here I am doing it with you. So there you go.
Well, and there's always a balance here in a public radio show like this, in that anything that is too exposing, you don't know what listeners are making of it. I mean, I think most listeners are just incredibly grateful at hearing real stories from real people on a real station. And I think that has a power all of its own. It's why I do this, because I think there's a need for us to talk more. And I think there's a need for us to know that it's okay. But you're right. You're right, Rachel. There is this incredibly powerful, determined, strong, stoic character to a great deal of New Zealand. And do you know, it's a quality I actually admire, despite being in my profession. I absolutely admire it. How many generations back, Rachel, does farming go in your family?
Oh, yeah, it goes a long way back from what I can figure out. Both sides of my family are British, clearly. My my parents were born in New Zealand, but both sides of their family are from Yorkshire, as much as I can gather. And Lancashire, actually. So that's right next door, I think. So, yeah, and my family goes back forever. I mean, I had a grandfather who, my father's father, came back from the Boer War and World War I, and he'd been mustard gas, and then he killed a Chinaman and got away with it. There's a whole book about it, and I'd never met the man. He was well dead before I came along. But again, he was such a stoic guy, and he went a bit mad with the mustard gas. He got whatever they call that, something. There is a word. It's a great book. It's called The Murder of Chow Yat. It's written by Joan Rosier Jones, and it's a fascinating read about New Zealand history, actually. But my grandfather clearly did it, and I'm quoted in the book as knowing that because my aunts told me that he said to them, "I'll cut your throat if you tell anyone I killed the Chinaman." But he never got caught for it because he had medals. You know, he was a big and he was a strong man. He'd go into town. He'd take the horse and cart into town from the farm about once a month. He'd get on the terps in town at the old Rutland Hotel, and he'd pick on a bald man and he'd start slapping him around the head. I've heard these stories from people that, you know, was handed down. And he'd pick a fight, and then he'd just beat the crap out of them and come home in time for milking the next day and feel better. So this is the sort of DNA in me. I don't know that I'd go and do that, but yeah. So it's a long line of this kind of thing, and they were military people too when they had to be. So that brings a whole other dimension. And I think, like, I had to agree to talk to you, Jerry. I had to think about it. I said I'd take a day to think about that when I was asked to talk to you, because I felt that was talking to you might be, you know, a bit weak, or do I really want to talk to Jerry about, you know, psychotherapy or anything going on with me? Or then I thought, no, bugger it, I'll do it. Because I listened to some of your shows and it felt good, it felt safe, it felt fine. And also I do see a therapist, and the reason I see a therapist from time to time, and it's not a weakness, it's just something that keeps me going, was because when I came back from that Wellington experience with my stepfather and a few things started to happen, I got into my early 20s and I thought, oh, I'm just not coping here, you know, this isn't going well. So I went and saw somebody at the Polytech in Whanganui who was, I don't even recall who she was, but she was brilliant. And she said, I do CBT, this is how I work. And I didn't have a clue what any of that meant. And she said, what's going on for you? And we had 6 free sessions. I remember it was covered by the government for some reason, I don't know. And it's so long ago. And I remember talking to her and she said, tell me about what happened with your mother. And, you know, we got into it and I just start crying. You know, I kept thinking, why am I crying? This is bizarre, because you just don't cry in my family. You're not supposed to cry. So she teased it all out of me. And then she said, I remember the turning point where I really had respect for her and what she was doing. She said, now, tell me about your nieces that you adore. And at that stage, they would have been 8, 10, 12, something like that, because I've got a bunch of nieces and nephews, and now great nieces and nephews. And how would you feel if they were in that situation that you just described to me when you were 8? And I remember going, oh, yeah, I could actually relate to that, because I felt for those kids. I loved those kids. I still love those kids. And I suddenly realized that was me, but I couldn't give myself permission to feel sad about me. But I could. And so she changed the way I look at things now. I'd always put someone I love in that situation and think about how I'd feel for them, that thing that happened to me. And yeah, so that's when I got respect for what you do. And I just see it as part of my life. So over my life now, I've probably gone to a number of maybe 4 different therapists, sometimes for relationship. I've been in a relationship for 25 years and we've had to have little tune-ups here and there. So no, I use it as a like a mechanic on a car, on my truck. I mean, if my truck's not working properly, it gets serviced every. So I'm not going to lie that, yeah, I think it's good for people to just see their mental health as something. I wouldn't be here, Jerry, if I hadn't come across you probably. I honestly think that. So it's kept me ticking along and having a really interesting life.
That's a beautiful description, really, of how therapy, counselling can be a real support. And in many ways, how you can get a different perspective. But, I mean, one of the ways I like to think of it is that in therapy, we get another perspective because, you know, when we are going through something, we've got all our baggage and all our background and all our history. So we see things in a certain way. And when we go and be with someone, or in some cases in groups, I love to do therapy groups as well, where you get a group of people, all of whom are sort of sharing, you know, that actually there are issues in life that affect us. But you get different perspectives. And very often in a group, one of the sort of loveliest techniques I use is someone says, you know, well, I want to talk about this, and we get a nice agreement. And I said, well, how about at the end, you hear what each person, what solution they have, and you can choose if any of them work for you. And so the person tells their story, as it were. And then each member of the group says, well, I think you should be doing this, or I think you should be doing that. And it's absolutely amazing because every single person has a different perspective on each person's material. So every single listener here is going to be, you know, hearing and responding slightly differently. And something about just going into a safe, private, confidential space, just laying out your situation. If nothing else, having another individual who's not caught up in the same history as you are or I am, and they listen to us, and you go, oh yeah, having a different perspective can be so powerful, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I will say here today, hand on heart, I would never do group therapy. For whatever reason, I just could never do it. But certainly going into that, that's the stoicism. I just can't do that sort of thing. I'm not really a group kind of person. But going to her and all the female therapists I've had, I haven't had male, actually. I just more circumstantial than anything else, has really at least, because they're not caught up in the drama. And, you know, it does feel a little bit self-indulgent at times to talk to someone about your feelings, but sometimes it's so cathartic too. So, yeah, and I would say from one year to the next I don't go to a therapist, but there are times when I go in a cluster because I realise I'm going off track and it's all, you know. But, yeah, no, I definitely admire what you do and respect it. And so I guess I'm a little bit different in that respect from my ancestors.
Yes, and in case you're wondering what you're listening to Reality Check Radio. This is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with me, Jerry Pives, and you're hearing Rachel Stewart share stories from her past, from her childhood, and the impact of those stories and those experiences. And what we're really exploring that I find so fascinating, Rachel, is we're exploring the roots of how we think and feel. And these farming roots that don't just go back to New Zealand, but actually by the sound of it, go all the way back to Britain. And do you know if your ancestors from the British end of things were, you said they were from the north of England. I actually spent 28 years of my life literally living on the border between Lancashire and Yorkshire. Do you know if they were farmers then, or do you know if they were other things? Do you know anything about that?
My father's side, I don't know so much. There was a bit of industry involved there, I think. My father's side, there was a lot of working in the Preston factories, I suppose. But yep. My mother's side, definitely, it was generation after generation after generation of her maiden name was such that if you go to a particular cemetery in the Pennines, called in a village called Dentdale, you will see her maiden name plastered all over the graves of this cemetery, going back to some, I think the last one that my uncle went and saw was 1600 something, and it was the same name. So, and it's an uncommon name. And so we just throughout Yorkshire everywhere, and probably, you know, you could argue that we're all inbred and a little bit weird, but who would know? I mean, I don't know. But that's where her family came from, and they were just generations of sheep farmers. Yep.
How far back were the first Kiwi farmers in your family then? Was it your grandfather?
It was my, on my mother's side, it was my great-grandfather, I think. And on my father's side, again, my great-grandfather, who came because he got a ballot farm from England. and he'd been a, you know, soldier, and so he ended up obviously taking Maori land, I'm sure, on the banks of the Whanganui River. We had a farm, and two generations from me, but it carries on in some form or another now. It's pretty much there. I'm third generation New Zealander.
And these ballot farms, they were after the First World War, were they?
Yes. It was fought. Sorry, he got it after, I'm pretty sure he got it after the Boer War, and then he went from New Zealand back to World War One, over to England. So he was sent back and went back over, and my oldest uncle ran the farm, the oldest son, because Dad was the youngest of six. So, yeah, he went back. So I think it was after Boer War, which was 1896, maybe, something like that. I do know the First World War. God. He'd been here quite a long time. Anyway, he died pretty young anyway. He died of a ulcer that burst in his stomach because of all the stress, I'm sure. And that was the end of him.
And isn't it amazing, Rachel, this pattern of trauma, in this case through war, both for your stepfather and your great-grandfather, trauma leading to, and I say trauma without any support or help to understand how to deal with that. And then we have the all-time solution to the pain that trauma brings, which is either drugs or alcohol. And very often with alcohol, we lose the inhibitions, and then the rage and the upset pours out in violence. This, you know, trauma, alcohol, violence. I wonder how many listeners can relate to that pattern in their own family right now as people are listening. And it all comes back to, what do we do with trauma, right?
Yeah, where do you put it? I mean, I drink, and I sometimes worry if I drink too much. I don't think I do. I've always drunk. When we finished hay making when we were a kid, we'd get made shandies, you know. And when we were older, we were allowed a beer. And I have so many good memories of watching the rugby and being able to have a beer with Dad. And so my memories of alcohol, because my father drank, but he wasn't violent at all. So he was a very gentle man, actually. He didn't pick up on any of that stuff. He was too young, I think, to get it from his father. I don't know, but he was a gentle person. My memories of alcohol are pretty good. For me, alcohol is a relaxant and has good memories, except around my stepfather, no. But, yeah, generally it's a good feeling for me, and I don't know if that's good or bad, but it is what it is. And I certainly don't see it as a problem in my life. It doesn't affect my life particularly.
Well, it's very interesting around the issue of alcohol. There's all sorts of ways that people use to evaluate that. And I think one of them is whether the people around you regard it as a problem. I think there'll be quite a few listeners who have had to stop drinking entirely because they can't maintain it. It's like it becomes accumulative and it grows and grows and grows and it gets out of control till you get to the binge and then you get to all the damage that it can do. I think there are lots of different views around that. But, you know, in general, I think the classic one is 21 units a week would qualify you as an alcoholic and 20 units wouldn't. So it's like...
I'll go with that.
And I think it's really interesting, Rachel, because alcohol in New Zealand is a very big problem. And I think, you know, the difficulty is when it starts to impact health or it impacts your functioning or it impacts your relationships. I think those are generally the indicators that people have for certainly people in my world. We say, well, how is it affecting you and what's happening? And, you know, in my approach, it's like rather than saying that I need to change something because I'm guilty, it's, well, do you need to change it? Why do you need to change it? And what might the impact of changing it be? And you're describing really a cultural root of alcohol, which I think is such an important subject. And at the end of the day, Rachel, I have no doubt from talking with you that if you decided it was harming you or your relationships or your functioning, you'd knock it on the head overnight. I've got that feeling about you.
Yeah, I would. If it got out of control, I would. And I'd know. I'd be, you're definitely right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Rachel, wow, I can't believe it, but we've run out of time, actually. We're coming to the end of this session. I wonder how you found it, sitting here chatting in the psychotherapist chair with me, what it's been like for you.
Just how bloody sane I am, really. but also, you've got a very warm, golden, syrupy voice. You feel very calm. You are very balanced, and you don't feel like some people can feel like when you're talking to them, like they're killing you with kindness or coddling you or something. I don't like that. So, no, it feels good. It's actually been good. I was a little bit nervous last night thinking about it, what it was going to be like, but no, this feels absolutely fine. So I've enjoyed talking to you, Jerry.
On behalf of the listeners, I just want to say a big thank you. You give absolutely masses. You speak out, you say things that many of us couldn't formulate as well as you do. You write amazingly. You're a real truth speaker, and sometimes that might agree with what I think, and sometimes it doesn't. I just love the fact that you're out there strutting your stuff, speaking out, you know, and I just want to say an enormous thank you for your courage. I know you think it's just normal, but for many listeners, I'm sure they're going to say, well, a world without Rachel Stewart would be a much more scary place, and having you out there swinging the bat for us is a real, real wonderful image to have.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's very nice.
So, listeners, look, don't go away yet, because I'm going to do some reflections. There have been lots of interesting things coming up here. And then I'm going to ask Rachel back to share her music with meaning. So hang on in, because Rachel's going to give us even more stories about her life and the music that has really done for her and helped her through her life. So hang on in there. But Rachel Stewart, thank you so much for having the courage to come out and sit right here in the psychotherapist chair. Thank you once again.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.